May it please the Court, Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant, David Buchanan. There are three issues before the Court today. The first is whether Mr. Buchanan's unlawful entry into his home amounted to not one, but both of the elements of burglary third degree. The second issue is whether Mr. Buchanan carried a concealed deadly weapon when he had no ready access to the weapons. And finally, whether Mr. Buchanan's transitory and good faith possession of a firearm amounted to knowingly possession by a person prohibited. The law requires a conclusion that the convictions underlying each of these issues be reversed. Excuse me. The state bootstrapped a misdemeanor into a felony in this case with the circular reasoning that Mr. Buchanan entered his home unlawfully with the intent to enter his home unlawfully. In this case, prior to Mr. Buchanan's entry into his home, the family court had issued an order prohibiting him from going in the home as a result of a very lengthy and complicated divorce proceeding. He felt his home was his castle, and he was a farmer, and he made money off of the farmland. However, this family court ordered that the home be sold and that the proceeds be split. He did not want that to happen. So on one particular day, he went into the home when he was not supposed to. However, there's no evidence that he intended to do anything else but occupy the home. And in fact, the facts reveal that he was in there and he had the chimney going, and then police arrested him. The criminal contempt in this case that he was then charged and convicted of cannot satisfy the second element of burglary, that he had the intent to commit an independent crime within the home. Burglary has two particular elements. One is unlawful entry, and the other is the intent to commit a crime therein. And burglary was designed to protect property. And in this case, that's significant, as the criminal contempt order was actually in place to protect the property, unlike a PFA where the defendant was to have no contact with the victim or his ex-wife in this particular case because they were concerned about harm to the person.
Ms. Walker, just as a conceptual matter, if we were to agree with the state that this contempt of the court's order was a continuing wrong or a continuing violation, what effect would that have in your argument?
It would have no effect, Your Honor. In fact, the only two cases that the state cited dealt with trying to establish that the content was a continuing offense. And the reason it wouldn't be a problem in this case, well, first of all, case law indicates that it's not a continuing offense. But if the court were to accept that and find that in Delaware, it would have to also determine that criminal trespass is an ongoing offense. I mean, he continues to occupy the home. He's continuing to unlawfully be there, which satisfies both offenses. So that does not create a distinction with respect to allowing it to be an additional offense. Now,
well, as I understood your brief, you were distinguishing the state's reliance on the person who stayed in a house to resist arrest and this particular case based on the fact that the conduct constituted a lesser included element of the burglary crime. Is
That's
that right?
Correct. Yes. It amounted to unlawful entry, which is another way of saying criminal trespass.
Well, why did it amount to unlawful entry? Why was it anything more than a violation of a family court order?
Well, the family court order is akin to a sign being placed on someone's yard that says no trespassing, or an old man coming out of his house and their kids in the grass in his yard and saying, get off of my lawn. The family court order said, your entry is unlawful. And when he violated that, he committed the contempt and criminal trespass. Therefore, it was the unlawful entry, and that is the...
You're conceding it's two crimes, that they're not inconsistent. If the sole basis for his illegal entry is the existence of a family court order saying that in order to resolve your domestic dispute peacefully, you can't enter your own home.
Correct.
All right. If he does so, he violates that order and he's subject to being held in contempt. But he still has no other basis for being charged with an unlawful entry.
Right.
He's not entering his neighbor's home for the purpose of committing a crime therein or remaining there unlawfully. He's still on the deed as of that moment.
Correct.
So why, as a matter of social policy, does he get punished twice? First, for violating the family court order, and secondly, for a felony burglary into his own property.
There is no public policy. It's very difficult because I would imagine not practicing a family court, but this may or may not arise often. Often what happens is it's the subject of a PFA, in which case you may, some courts find and some don't, that the intent was to protect the person versus the property, and criminal trespass is a property-protecting offense.
Well, you mentioned that this was a farm of some type. Was he still farming it, permitted to be on the land but not in the house? Is that a distinction that we'd find in the record?
The record, this is a very complicated case, and what appears from the record is that he was not allowed to be on the property at all.
So once he entered the property, he was violating the family court order.
Correct.
And it wasn't enhanced in any way by going into the house, except to the extent he then got charged with burglary.
Correct. That's exactly right. And when other courts have found that it is not the same and that there can be two separate charges, they've looked to the defendant's conduct that happens inside and that you can infer that there's other crimes. He goes in, he starts beating the woman or starts kicking the woman. The jury could infer there was some other intent to be in there.
Just to backtrack for a moment, Ms. Walker, the family court order, the violation of the family court order constituted a criminal trespass, correct?
Correct.
And it also constituted a contempt. The other side argues yes, but the contempt was a continuing wrong, so it can serve double duty here. And your response is no, even if it is an ongoing or continuing wrong, in order to satisfy the burglary requirement of the burglary statute, it has to be a qualitatively different offense. Is that correct?
Yes. If you look at the Patrick and Burton cases, resisting arrest was addressed there, and this court said it's a continuing offense, unlike escape. That's a completely different offense than just entering the home. I mean, those gentlemen were entering the home to do something completely different. And I'm sorry, I didn't know if you. And in this case, I guess the best way to establish it is that the court order made the entry unlawful. So violating that was entering the property contrary to what he was supposed to do. The second issue before the court today.
You would also argue that if he, putting aside the burglary, he just enters the property and he stays on the property for hours. It's a continuing offense, but when he would go to the family court, they would only say he committed one violation, notwithstanding the length. So here, what we have is this continuing violation that turns it into an entirely different crime. Is that right? In the state's view.
In the state's view. I guess my position is that there is only one crime, criminal trespass, in this case, because there was only one conduct. And the minute it's completed, each of them are completed, contempt and criminal trespass, the minute he enters the property, it is not a continuing offense. Someone can remain criminally trespassing on the property, but as soon as he enters, that's the end of it.
Well, as I understand your position, you're conceding two offenses, criminal contempt and criminal trespass.
I don't believe that's the case.
How can it not be if you're conceding that the basis for the unlawful entry was a violation of the family court order, and therefore it was an illegal entry because it violated the family court order?
I guess this is difficult to explain, but let's say somebody had a sign on a yard that said no trespassing. Now, obviously, it's different than a court order. The fact that that's there and he disobeys that sign is not different than the fact that he's entering. He's entering unlawfully. There's not two separate conduct. There's two separate conduct is not occurring. There's just one thing. So the court order is putting him on notice. The violation is once he enters, and that's one offense.
Well, the court order is putting him on notice, but the court order also is punishing him for entering that property contrary to the court order. And the question I have in my mind still is, what is justifiable about prosecuting him, finding him in contempt, and sentencing him for his violation of the order, and charging him with felony burglary or criminal trespass?
It's
the same activity.
Correct.
Why the double punishment?
There shouldn't be a double punishment.
Well, there was.
Exactly. And that was incorrect, because the criminal trespass is the same conduct as the contempt. And that's what this whole thing's about. It's a lesser included offense of the burglary, so that's why we're dealing with the burglary. Had he been convicted of criminal trespass and the contempt, we would be dealing simply with that, the lesser included offense.
Okay.
I'm sorry if that wasn't clear.
And are you going to address your other two arguments?
Yes, Your Honor. I just wanted to point out with the carrying the concealed deadly weapon that the circumstances reveal that he is not was not in ready access to the weapons at the time that he was arrested.
Well, you say that, and you know that we recently decided a case called Madry and a subsequent case. And yes, in both of those, we said access was really a fact to be resolved by the trier of fact. And you recall in that case, the gun was in a safe in a closet. We've had all sorts of variations on that. Yeah. My question is, why isn't this simply an argument to be made to the trier of fact as opposed to something that we would resolve as a matter of law?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. In Dubin versus State, the court actually reversed the conviction on the grounds that the trial court did not grant a motion to dismiss, so it was considered a legal issue there. Carrying a concealed deadly weapon is different than those cases that Your Honor mentions. It's possession. You know, carrying carries with it 23 different definitions in Webster's. But under Black's Law Dictionary, it says carrying weapons actually is being on the person ready for offensive or defensive use. It's designed to target.
That means it has to be loaded.
Well, that's an argument. A deadly weapon could be, you could smack them over the head with the weapon, so it wouldn't necessarily have to be loaded.
Let's be clear on what we're talking about here. When you talk about those cases that Justice Holland mentioned or referring to something else, those cases dealt with how one approaches the concept of possession.
Correct.
Factually and legally, in either a person having possession while being prohibited or possession during the commission of a felony. Carrying a concealed deadly weapon, you're suggesting to us, is different from both of those.
Yes. However, now, I'm sorry.
Tell us, how is it different when one analyzes the facts to determine whether an individual is carrying a concealed deadly weapon as opposed to possessing it while being a person prohibited?
Okay. This court made a nice distinction between possession of a deadly weapon by a person prohibited and possession during the commission of the crime. And this court held that when you're prohibited, possession is a little different than possession during a commission of a felony. You can't possess it at any time. Possession during the commission of a felony is a specific set of facts that it has to be readily accessible then. Carrying a concealed deadly weapon is similar to that in that it addresses a different set of circumstances. The intent by the legislature was to prevent someone from taking a gun to a fist fight. Someone can own a concealed deadly weapon. The point is having it available so when you get upset and you get mad, you just yank the gun out and shoot somebody. And that's what the cases in this court addressing carrying concealed deadly weapons or possession actually have concluded. If it's on the mat, loaded, he can take it out. In this case, Mr. Buchanan would have had to reach behind the seat, pull it out, unzip the bag, take the gun, load the gun, and then shoot it.
So you're conceding that the gun had to be loaded in order for the statute to be triggered?
Well, if he's in the car driving and that's how he's going to use it, that would be the circumstances under Carter versus State. That would be the circumstances in which it would be used. It wouldn't whether it's a deadly weapon depends on the circumstances.
What you seem to be suggesting, whether it's a deadly weapon depends on whether it's loaded.
Depending on the circumstances.
Well, I think in order to, for me to be able to resolve this, we need to focus on the distinction between the analysis for carrying a concealed deadly weapon as opposed to possessing it under any other circumstances that might cause that possession to be illegal.
Right. Now, what is it about these facts that suggest that he wasn't carrying it within the meaning of the statute? Forget about whether the weapons are loaded or not,
okay,
because in my mind, we have plenty of cases that suggest the deadly weapon simply has to be deadly.
Right.
Presence or absence of loaded ammunition has
right.
nothing to do with it.
Right. Like I said, the guns were unloaded. They were with ammunition that were in the manufacturer's packaging or the box that he purchased them in. They were behind the front passenger seat in a zip bag. So for him to have access, and under Dubin, we look at the ability to access it, whether he has to appreciably change his position, and whether the amount of time it would take. So the amount of time it would take for, specifically would be significant. You have to reach back there, unzip the bag, take out the weapon, take out the ammunition, load the gun, all while driving with one hand, or he would have to stop the car to do that. So that clearly is not what the legislature had in mind. They did not want someone to have the gun under the mat, get mad, do a drive-by shooting. They didn't want somebody to go to a fist fight, get mad, run and get the gun and shoot him, or have the gun on him and shoot him. That's what carrying a concealed deadly weapon is designed to attack. And other jurisdictions who are the same intent have found when something's enclosed, it's not carrying. In Dubin, this court said, in a dashboard, a glove box in a dashboard was not carrying a weapon because it would take time. So that's what's being targeted. If it was possession of a concealed deadly weapon would be probably acceptable. But it wasn't possession, it's carrying. The distinction between the words, even though carrying is not specifically defined in the code, it is regularly understood as being on the person ready for use.
Okay, you want to save your rebuttal time?
I believe Justice Jacobs had a question.
I just wanted to ask one question. If we were to conclude that in these circumstances the defendant wasn't carrying the weapon, would he nonetheless be possessing it? Would he have possessed it?
Well, in this particular case, the argument is no. There's no knowing possession by a person prohibited, and that's my third argument because it was a good faith possession. Thank you. I will reserve the rest.
Good morning. Abby Adams on behalf of the State of Delaware. Your Honors, as the trial prosecutor pointed out in his closing, this case is about the fact that David Buchanan does whatever David Buchanan wants to do. And in this case, he flagrantly, persistently violated multiple family court orders. He's raised three issues on appeal: the sufficiency of the evidence to convict him of burglary in the third degree with respect to his entering his home in violation of a family court order, the sufficiency of the evidence to convict him of carrying a concealed deadly weapon, which were found in his car as he left family court in violation of family court order, and the sufficiency of the evidence for his convictions on three counts of possessing firearms by a person prohibited. The burglary conviction, burglary in the third degree, stands because Buchanan entered the building with the intent to continuously violate the court order, as evidenced by 2 years prior of his continual violation of various orders of the family court. When the family court issued its initial division of property.
Are you suggesting that Mr. Buchanan should be punished by a felony burglary conviction because he was a frequent, persistent, consistent, continuous violator of family court orders? Because each of those family court orders has an element of punishment attached to it, doesn't it?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. Yes, they do. Pardon me. The state is suggesting that his, over a period of 2 years, his persistent violation of those orders evidences his intent to continually violate the order once he got in the house, his intent to live there.
Well, the order has a contempt citation attached to it, and the family court's perfectly able, has the power to punish him for violating its order. What does the burglary add to it, other than jail time?
Well, actually, in this case, he received 3 months of work release for the burglary conviction.
Well, the potential jail time. Nobody should ever minimize the potential jail time that a felony imposes on someone, particularly when they'll be under probation and subject to serving the entire 7 years or whatever at any point in the future.
And he was convicted of criminal contempt of the family court order in this case. The burglary, the state maintains, more correctly reflects what he did. He didn't just enter the property, walk across the line in violation of a no trespassing sign. He entered the house with the intent to stay there and continue his violation of the family court order. And the state,
but the only reason his entry was illegal was because there was a family court order telling him not to enter, correct? He's still on the deed.
Yes.
It's his property.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why does he then get punished both for burglary and violation of the family court order, when the family court order is the sole basis for his entry being illegal?
Well, the state maintains that the elements of the burglary are the intent to enter the building, entering the building unlawfully, and the intent to violate the court order. And I understand the court equating the violation of the court order with basically unlawfully entering the building. The state maintains that it really is an elevation and a separate offense, and that a separate violation for burglary is appropriate in this case on these facts.
For me, you'll need to explain why. Because the family court says, thou shalt not enter thine own property. The word of the Lord. He violates the family court order, which is punishable by criminal contempt. He gets punished for violating that court order. Why burglary on top of that?
Well, just in the situation with burglary and robbery, the two offenses have different elements, so the state charged under two separate offenses.
Well, what's the different element? Both are entering a home illegally.
And certainly it's up to the court to construe. How the court construes the elements of this case will decide that issue, but the state maintains that the burglary third was the intent to enter the building, the unlawful entry in the building with the specific intent to violate a family court order, which is beyond just stepping across a no trespassing sign. And the actual contempt is just knowledge of a order and the intentional violation of that order.
Well, but as I understand burglary, it's the unlawful entry with the intent to commit a crime therein. Stilted language, but I think that's the language from the statute. He committed no crime while he was there. The crime he committed was entering the building contrary to the family court order.
I understand Your Honor's position. The state respectfully
submits. It's not my position, it's my question.
I'm sorry.
I'm still trying to figure out what my position is going to be.
The state submits that it wasn't just over as soon as he crossed the threshold of the house. The state maintains that this is a continuing offense, that he continually snubbed his nose at the family court order, and had every intent to stay in that home for as long as he could. He had no intention to leave there.
The concept of this being a continuing offense is critical to your position. Is that correct?
Yes.
How do you respond to Ms. Walker's argument that as a legal matter, that's not enough, that it would take an intent to commit an entirely separate, qualitatively different offense or crime in order to qualify for a conviction under the burglary statute?
Well, I agree that this is a difficult case, as Ms. Walker explained.
Let me ask the question differently. The notion that this is a continuing offense you know, is a bit of a legal fiction that courts sometimes indulge in order to achieve a result. This may or may not be one of them, but I think there is a bit of the fictitious about it. Now, that's all right if that serves a public policy purpose. And what the Chief Justice was asking and what I'm asking is what policy is served by using these are my words, not yours or his, the bootstrap of a continuing offense in order to achieve a felony conviction for burglary.
Well, if the court looks just at the criminal contempt instead of the criminal contempt and the burglary, the criminal contempt conviction can be seen to be essentially the trespass, the initial going on the property, where the burglary conviction really punishes Mr. Buchanan for living in that home, for not listening to the repeated orders of the family court to obey the property division. So the public policy there is that it's just the continuing violation of the family court order.
So the public policy that you believe is sound is to punish Mr. Buchanan under these circumstances in the same way you would punish Mr. Buchanan or anyone else for entering my property without my permission, staying there without my permission, and taking my television set or smashing my wife's crystal or something. The public has just as much interest in felonizing what Mr. Buchanan did as it would someone entering unlawfully into someone else's home and committing a crime therein.
And that is how the state has charged it in this case, yes.
Okay.
With respect to Mr. Buchanan's second argument that he did not, that he was not carrying a concealed deadly weapon, the state maintains that, first of all, this claim is reviewed for sufficiency of the evidence, whether there is, in the light most favorable to the state, sufficient evidence for a reasonable fact finder to find each element of that crime. And the state maintains that there was evidence in the record that, and the only issue here really is the accessibility of the two guns that were on the floor behind the passenger seat. The state maintains that there was ample evidence in the record for the jury to find Mr. Buchanan guilty of carrying a concealed deadly weapon, as they did. The trooper who arrested him testified that the bag that was behind the passenger seat of the Honda Accord that he was driving, so it's a relatively small car, was within his reach. And
without stopping the car?
Does
it matter that he would have had to stop the car for purposes of applying this statute?
The state maintains he wouldn't have had to stop the car. You could reach behind the passenger seat without stopping the car. The officer didn't testify with respect to that specific.
No, but if it were necessary to stop the car.
If it were necessary to stop the car, that would be a different case, yes.
Right. Would that be possession?
It would be possession, yes. Carrying would be different.
Okay, last question. Does the, in order to trigger liability under the concealed carrying statute, is it necessary that the gun, assuming it's accessible, be loaded?
No.
I'm sorry, did you say yes?
No, I said no. It does not need to be loaded in order for him to be carrying a concealed deadly weapon.
When the police officer testified about the accessibility, were the guns or a gun and boxed ammunition in a zipped bag?
Yes, they were.
Did he testify that he could reach the bag, or did he testify that he could reach the bag, unzip it, and take a weapon out?
The officer testified that he could reach the bag. It was up to the jury to infer that he could, if he could reach the bag, that then he could obtain it, unzip it, and get the weapon out. Now, there was no specific testimony about that. It stopped with reaching the bag.
Do you agree that the carrying is something different than merely possessing?
Yes.
How is it different?
I think in this case, the possession by a person prohibited, obviously, and that's the third argument in this case, applies wherever those weapons are in the car. If they're in the trunk, if they're locked in a safe, locked in the trunk, it's still possession because he has dominion and control over that car, and it's his car and everything in it. Here, in Dubin, the court has utilized the three-factor test to determine what is accessibility with respect to carrying a concealed deadly weapon. And those factors, as the court knows, involve...
So possession means you have to have control. Carry means you have to have control plus access.
Yes. And the state maintains that these weapons on the floor behind the passenger seat in a zipped bag together with the ammunition were readily accessible to him as testified by the trooper and as found by the jury.
Do you agree that if he'd had the weapons unconcealed on the back seat or a rifle or a shotgun on a rack in the back over the back window of a pickup truck, that he wouldn't be guilty of carrying a concealed deadly?
It's not concealed at that point.
Ironic, isn't it?
With respect to the third argument, Mr. Buchanan argues that he innocently had the weapons when he left the family court. And that argument is against the weight of the evidence. There was a temporary protection from abuse order entered by the family court that had been served on him prior to the hearing, which in bold face type, and it was admitted as State's Exhibit 16, says you are prohibited by this court from possessing any weapons. He had that document. An officer testified that he'd served that document on him, or it had been served on him on the 10th for the 13th hearing. Instead, he drove his car to the hearing with the guns in his possession. That temporary PFA was made permanent, and there he was violating the statute when he left the hearing. There was no innocent, he can't claim innocence in that regard. And even if he had not been served the temporary PFA, by the time it was made permanent at the hearing, he should have and had every opportunity to turn the weapons over to the court at that time as well. He clearly knew they were in the car because he told the trooper when he was pulled over.
Why would he turn them over to the court?
Not necessarily the court, the police. He could have told the court that he had the weapons and made arrangements to have someone get them so that he would not have to leave the courthouse and be immediately in violation of the crime. Not necessarily the court.
As I understood the argument on the other side, it's not so much that he claims innocence or ignorance of the existence of the temporary order, but he seems to claim that between the time of the entry of the temporary order and the final order, he should have been given a reasonable period of time to separate himself from the weapons. And they seem to believe that the period of time he had was not reasonable. What's your response to that?
Between the temporary order and the temporary order being made permanent?
The issuance of the order that put him on notice that he was not to possess a weapon, he was prohibited from possessing it. Forget about any distinction between temporary and permanent. You are correct. The temporary order said you can't possess the weapons. I read the brief as suggesting that people should be given a reasonable period of time to dispossess themselves and that this short window of time was insufficient. What's your response to that?
The state would maintain that 3 days is more than sufficient time for him to have dispossessed himself of the ammunition, having been served the order. Given the nature of a PFA, it's to protect someone from potential injury. I think that window would be a very, very small amount of time. When he was served and he received the temporary order, he had a duty at that point to, I can't remember from the record if it was an officer that served him, to say, I have guns and I need to turn them over. 3 days, the state would maintain, is too long in this situation for him to rely on the idea that he was still innocently possessing them.
You keep talking about him turning over the weapons. Where in our law does it require that someone turn their weapons over to the police or to the court. I thought they just weren't supposed to possess weapons.
Well, they aren't supposed to possess weapons. I'm trying to remember if the temporary order explains that, but I know that in the final order, it does say that you're not supposed to possess weapons.
I'm thinking of the very startled look on a family court judge's face when somebody walks up with a bag full of pistols.
Well, no, and I understand, Your Honor. And what I was saying was that he could have informed the family court that he had weapons and made arrangements for someone to take them into custody. I believe the final PFA order talks about, the temporary says, you may seek the return of any weapons or property seized or surrendered pursuant to the final order. It sort of anticipates that if he has nowhere else to put them, he gives them to the state police or something of that nature. He wouldn't get them in the federal court.
An alternative is he could lock them in a safe in his basement.
No, he could not, because then he would still be possessing them.
He could lock them in a safe in a friend's basement.
That's an interesting question. Fortunately, not the facts here, but I would say no. If that friend would still give him access, he still has potential.
Well, that's a point probably of interest only to me, but it's not part of the case. But thank you for helping me understand it.
Do you have any general sense, independent of this case, on how the criminal statute and the family court contempt power are being used in these domestic dispute cases? If we look at this third argument, and you know, we accept the record reflects he was told you shouldn't possess firearms. So we have a situation even in the third argument where he's in contempt of the temporary order by having the weapons. But it doesn't appear that that contempt was ever pursued by the family court. Instead, he was charged with the criminal offense of possession by a person prohibited. And then we go back to the first argument, which is the burglary. He could be found in contempt, which was pursued in this case, but in addition, the state wants him charged with burglary. And as the questions from the Chief Justice in particular indicated, it seems that maybe the same conduct shouldn't necessarily result in a duplication of punishment, that it's almost like an election of remedies. You either pursue the criminal offense or you pursue the contempt. But at least in the first instance, your argument is the state should be able to pursue both. And so my question is, do you have any sense of how this is operating in the family court?
My short answer is I don't, Your Honor. I can only conjecture based on, and I see I'm about out of time if I can finish your question. I can only extrapolate based on what happened in this case, that initially there was a family court order that said this property shall be sold, and Mr. Buchanan did not cooperate with that. And then there was an order that evicted him from the property, and he did not cooperate with that. And then the family court had to issue an order permitting the state police or whatever applicable law enforcement authority to physically remove him from the property. And it wasn't until after that stage that this came to be. So I guess my answer to your question is I can only conjecture based on this case that it's not something that they immediately go to this kind of an offense. It has to be a repeated problem in order to resort to this.
During the time, we all recognize you're out of time, but you, for better or worse, you've spurred our interest. During these repeated violations of family court orders, was he for each violation prosecuted for contempt?
Not to my knowledge.
Did he suffer punishment?
No, not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
Does the record show why not?
There's nothing in the record of this case that shows why not, no. At some point, all of those orders were lifted temporarily during a bankruptcy proceeding that he had filed in district court, and they had just been reinstated prior to this last incident. But the record doesn't reflect the reasons why it wasn't pursued previously.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I would just like to correct two factual points with respect to the last issue. The first one is with respect to the temporary order that was issued on March 7th. It states that it expires on March 13th. In other words, by the time he got to court at 8:30 in the morning on the 13th, he arguably was no longer prohibited under the temporary order. Secondly, he was charged for violating the permanent order, not the temporary order, and that's what we're here for. The only reason I raised the point in the brief with respect to the innocent possession is it goes to the test of good faith with respect to this case. And the bottom line is this is simply not fair to Mr. Buchanan.
Well, the test under the statute is knowing. And I don't think there can be any dispute that all along he knew. It sounds like you're trying to create or engraft some exception, whether you call it an innocence exception or a good faith exception. What's the basis for that?
Well, it counters the knowing. Knowing says he has to be practically certain that his conduct is going to result in the crime. The state in its brief said, well, he had a hint when he went there that he would be violating the statute. And as Chief Justice Steele points out, the only way for him to come out of possession is he's got to get rid of it. You know, turning it into the court, would that have been so wise? Would a reasonable person think, I'm going to walk into the courthouse and turn this in, or would he have to have some time to decide, what am I going to do with this?
Well, wouldn't you concede that any reasonable person, once the temporary order issued, would make sure that any deadly weapons that they had access to would be placed so far away from any claim of access until this was all resolved that there couldn't even be an issue, particularly somebody with his history of in and out of PFAs and in and out of contempt situations?
And that's certainly a fact that the court needs to look at with respect to the entire test. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for a very interesting argument. We'll take it under advisement and recess.